Good morning. May it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. And since the time is short, I'd like to take the Court through a very brief nickel tour of the facts because I think it'll be relevant to the discussion. Imagine this courtroom is a stope in the Asarco mine. Prior to these events, Asarco used to drill the floor. They blow up the floor, muck out the ore, and the miners were relatively safe under what looks like giant chain-link fencing on the ceiling with four-foot bolts every 4 feet, keeping the rocks from falling on their heads when they blow up the stope, the floor. Asarco came in, changed hands, and said, "We're ripping out all of that roof, those chain-link fencing, we're ripping out all the roof bolts, and we're going to make our miners drill into the ceiling in successive 12-foot cuts, blow them up, and then go in the next day after we muck out the ore, and in a mine, imagine this courtroom, which is pitch black, so you can't see anything that your headlight doesn't illuminate, which is incredibly noisy because they're blowing air in, so you can't hear communications with other people, and which is smoky because of the heavy equipment. They tell them, their miners, tell you what, guys, if you're worried about one of these rocks falling on you when this thing is 24 or 36 feet, well, so what? Go up there with a crowbar and try to predict which one's going to fall on your head and crowbar it down. Well, Mr. Villanueva's daughter, Mr. Villanueva, Mr. Olson, and Mr. Vargas are all experienced miners. And Mr. Villanueva's going home and saying, I'm going to die. And his daughter tries to do something. She writes an anonymous letter to the federal mine inspector and says, this is what they're doing. They're taping off the stopes so you guys don't go in and see them, and they're not using roof bolting. You got to save these miners. And the mine inspector does nothing. There's no notes whatsoever as to what he does with these. 5 subsequent phone calls go into that federal mine inspector's office. There are no notes whatsoever. The only thing that the subsequent investigations reveal may have happened is Mr. Kirk may have told Mr. Varlin, and before the last inspection, before the tragic accident, check the ground. He may have done that. It's undisputed that he never told him, check to see if they're taping off stopes. And it is undisputed, Lee Ratliff, when Emshaw says, let's go investigate why these guys are dead, Lee Ratliff said, I could find no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Varlin ever checked the claim that they were taping off the stopes. And Mr. Kirk, his supervisor, said, I had no idea they were doing this backstoping, which is what they
call it. Is all this information that you're giving us now on the first round or when it was remanded back to district court and further discovery, what was learned in the further discovery relative to these facts?
Well, in the first discovery, this court had the Office of Inspector General report, which largely discussed some of these facts. The facts of what the different miners said the different inspectors said in deposition was not known at that time, and so it has been supplemented.
Now, because the district court ordered further, when it was remanded back.
Right. We had 6 months of discovery.
Okay. So can you tell me what was found out new in that new discovery?
I can tell you a couple things that are disputed, but which I can describe the testimony. Mr. Kirk said, I told Mr. Varland to go in and check the ground at some point. Mr. Varland says, yeah, I think he did that. Mr. Ratliff, who investigated it, says it's not clear that that's what happened because I could find no notes, but that's what they claim. Mr. Ratliff also said it is absolutely clear that there is no evidence that Kirk told Varlin to check the taping off, and in fact, there's absolutely no evidence because Kirk testified in the depositions, this was learned new, he said, I had no idea this backstoping was going on.
Okay, so now you have these old facts, if you will, first round.
Right.
You have new depositions, new facts, second round.
True enough.
And you're still in the position, as I understand the district court's second order, under motion to dismiss and motion for summary judgment.
True.
Okay, so now do we have a disputed issue of fact relative to these significant terms?
No, Your Honor. That was leading to my first point. There's several points raised in the brief, but because of timing, I wanted to address 2. First, Autry versus U.S. required the judge to apply a summary judgment standard to these disputed facts. It's clear, if there are disputed facts, we're entitled to the benefit of the doubt on those facts, and if there are material issues of fact, we're entitled to a trial on them. But the judge applied the wrong standard. And by the way, the government concedes at page 17 of their brief that Autry is the correct standard. And then,
so on the remand, Supreme Court, Ninth Circuit remand, you're saying that now we're in summary judgment, he should have applied those and there was disputed issues?
Well, they filed a motion to dismiss on the discretionary function, motion for summary judgment on the whether Arizona law recognizes a claim. But the Autry requires on both of those issues, because the facts are intertwined with the facts that go to merits, that he apply a summary judgment standard.
Key point you just made. The facts are intertwined between the first issue, motion to dismiss, and the summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor, and the government concedes that at page 17 of their brief.
Now, does that mean that when we remand it back to the district court to explore with further discovery the tort issue?
Yes.
That the intertwined facts opened up the first issue, the jurisdictional question?
Your Honor, I don't believe it did that, and you know, I'm not here to tell the court. I think what the law that addresses that is, what did this court intend when it remanded? What did the Supreme Court intend when it took only one issue and then vacated the court's
position? We're going to decide that. What's your position on it?
Well, my position is it was already ruled on, and these additional facts, in any event, did nothing that made the government's position any better, and so the ruling ought to be the same even if this court revisits it.
Let's break that into pieces. If, in fact, discovery had revealed a very different set of facts than was discussed by the court the first time around, I take it you would accept the proposition that the court could pay attention to the very different set of facts.
I accept the proposition that there is a case cited by the government that says that, and it makes good sense.
Once we're in that situation where actually everything's going to fall to the second half of your allegation, were the facts different, or applying a summary judgment standard, is the evidence such that summary judgment was or was not appropriate?
It's not appropriate, and Your Honor, I'm going to go into, let's talk, but first I want to say, if the court will make a note to look at page 9 of Judge Burry's brief, he applies the wrong standard, and he says, I get to make the factual determinations here.
In page 9 of which?
Order. So in my ER, I think it's in both of them, it's the second tab at page 9 of his order, he applied the wrong standard. And the government seems to concede, at page 17 of their brief, he applied the wrong standard.
With regard to the motion for summary judgment?
With respect to the motion to dismiss.
Motion to dismiss, which would be the first page then.
Is everybody with me now? I want to now talk about why it has to be a factual issue entitled to a trial. Judge Burry basically makes the decision that the MSHA's manual trumps the day. MSHA's manual says that if you don't have a signed written complaint, then that...
May I stop? Yeah. You're talking about when he said that the court may receive and consider extrinsic evidence and doing so allowed broad discretion. Is that what you're concerned about?
Well, actually, what I'm saying is, he says, but may instead weigh the evidence before it and find the facts, which is, in fact, not what Autry allows. If they're disputed facts, Autry requires a trial on the merits.
And you say this on page 9?
Yeah, at line 5.
Toward the top. Oh, yeah, I've got it underlined. Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So now he's saying it's got to be this manual. That tells him what to do. And I said, well, wait a minute. You know, this is evidence. What evidence did I come up with? First, I have the MSHA's own investigation, authored by Lee Ratliff, an acting assistant director of MSHA, saying that what happened was not in accordance with policy. First piece of evidence. Second piece of evidence. Oh, the Office of Inspector General report, which says that the inspector and the supervisor did not follow various MSHA policies and procedures. Second thing. And if you're not following policies, I submit, Your Honor, you are not acting with discretion. And third thing, Mr. Kirk was reprimanded. He was demoted. He's the supervisor. He was demoted. In doing that, Jake D. Herrera, acting district manager for MSHA Rocky Mountain District, says guidance was provided to the supervisory staff on March 17, 1999. We have the day that all complaints were to be investigated immediately, regardless of the method used to notify MSHA. So whatever you think the 1996 manual means, the 1999 guidance at least creates a fact question whether they changed it. So that's my third thing. My absolutely favorite piece of evidence is the letter which J. Davitt McTeer, second guy at OSHA, writes on behalf of then-President Clinton to my client, Amparo Villanueva, in which he says, I want to reemphasize the agency's policy for responding to complaints by minors. That policy requires that all hazard complaints be investigated as soon as possible, not that only the ones written and signed be investigated.
Does that cut into the whenever the best evidence comes in, cut into the fact that Kirk may or may not have told Varland?
Sure.
What?
Well, there's a factual dispute what he did. But let's take, for instance, let me make it a hypothetical.
Let me make sure that you and I are on the same page, because that would mean that if Kirk processed, if you will, analyzed, if you will, evaluated the anonymous, and he said, well, I'll tell you what, we got an inspection coming up. It was either April or September, I'm not sure.
September.
He tells Varland, when you go in there, check blank, whatever was said, then that would kind of decide that issue, whether it was done properly, wouldn't it?
It may well, depending on exactly what was said. Let me respond with a hypothetical I wanted to use. Say, in that conversation, Kirk says, go and cite them. You, Mr. Varland, you go and cite them. And Varland doesn't do it. Is there seriously some argument that that's barred by the discretionary function when he's been told by his boss, go cite these guys? And so now there's a disputed fact. What did his boss tell him?
It kind of depend upon what Varland said, the reason for not citing.
My point exactly. These are fact issues that should not be resolved without a trial on the merits.
You made your point good, because I, very frankly, reading this record, I was trying to determine where we should be on this because of the new discovery.
Sure.
And once you get into the new discovery, and if you do come up with disputed facts, now what do we do?
Well, then you have a trial on the merits. And actually, I brought a citation, Your Honor, from another circuit. And I'm sorry, I can't put my hand in it. But the case law, if you cite Autry, will say that when the discretionary function, when the facts that go to jurisdiction are disputed, you have a trial on the merits, and then you revisit that issue.
Then tell me what I do with this. The bottom line of the district court order is it is ordered that defendant motion to dismiss and defendant's motion for summary judgment are granted.
That's my second.
Granted both of them.
That's just my second issue, and that's why I'm moving pretty fast here, Your Honor. The second issue basically says Arizona law doesn't allow a cause of action here. And you need to know what Judge Burry did. Page 34 and 35 of his order, you need to look at this very closely. He did not find there was no reliance. He didn't find they didn't cause a harm. He found that M. Shaw did not do an undertaking to benefit ASARCO or the miners. Okay? And that's critical, because remember, this is an issue of Arizona law. All right? And he cites United States versus Page, which, by the way, is a case that talks about what's called the private-public duty distinction, which used to be a basis on which government actors weren't held liable because there was a public duty rather than a private duty owed to a particular person. Arizona does not follow that doctrine. And the cases is in our brief. It's Ryan versus State. But Judge Burry basically relied on a case from a district out of the state for a proposition that Arizona doesn't follow.
It's a Tenth Circuit case.
Yeah, well, we're not in the Tenth Circuit. And Ryan versus State is an Arizona Supreme Court case. Arizona does not follow the public-private distinction standard. But
he's talking about there the safety activities of the government versus what the tort liability is.
And he uses that to conclude that when ASARCO goes in and does this inspection, it's not doing anything for ASARCO, it's not doing anything for the miners. And frankly, I don't understand that analysis, and I'm moving fast, but I got something to say on that. 801G, M. Shaw statute, 30 U.S.C. 801G. It is the purpose of this chapter to establish standards to protect the health and safety of the nation's coal or other miners. So the purpose is to protect the safety of miners. Why did it do inspections? Authorized reps of the secretary, that's M. Shaw, shall make frequent inspections for the purpose of determining whether an imminent danger exists and determining whether there is compliance with the mandatory health or safety standards. So they go out to see, are these miners in imminent danger? Are they complying with these standards we adopted for the miner? And what is it, even in Judge Burry's own order, he cites 801G, which is the initial MTRA, 801A says the first priority and concern of all in the coal or other mining industries must be the health and safety of its most precious resource, the miner.
I know you're going fast, but we have to understand, too. What were you reading from now?
The statute, the MCHOS statute, now, 30 USC 801A.
Now, is that the statute also provides mandatory four-time-year full mine inspections?
It does. All right. My point only that the judge takes and basically goes through, and I know it's a complicated analysis, but turns it on its head to say that a SARCO, when it goes in to inspect for the purpose of ensuring the safety of miners, is not engaged in an undertaking for either a SARCO or the miners. And the reason that's relevant is under the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 323, if it's an undertaking to benefit the miners, then there's liability. And under 324, if it's an undertaking to benefit a SARCO that you should realize would benefit the miners, Then there is liability. What Judge Burry finds is it's neither of those things, and so he doesn't even reach the reliance issue, whether there's evidence of reliance. And with all due respect to Judge Burry, that analysis, that it is not on behalf of the miners or a SARCO, is nonsense. 323 and 324, if you look at the reporter's notes, specifically actually cite to a case, which is in our brief, called State versus Clymer, which is a mine inspector case. And they make the point that under State versus Clymer, when the state of Tennessee, pretty sure it's Tennessee, sends an inspector in there and the inspector's negligent, a cause of action, that mine inspector can be, the injured person has a cause of action because that kind of undertaking is an undertaking that benefits the class of miners. And that's Arizona law, and the reason Judge Burry gets it wrong with all due respect is because he relies on U.S. versus Page, which adopts this public-private duty distinction that Arizona doesn't recognize. And again,
he first played with the Restatement of Torts 323. And then when he gets to the 324A, he then does not cite any Arizona law. I agree with you there. But he does cite the United States versus Page. You see, that's where his error is.
Yeah, because it adopts a rule that there is not in Arizona, which, by the way, if you're going to ask me about Reimer and Myers and all those cases, they are all public-private duty distinction cases that are not Arizona law. Arizona law is what controls here. The public-private duty distinction is basically if somebody owes a duty to the entire public, like, for instance, a government inspector. Used to be, because, you know, as a remnant of sovereign immunity, you weren't liable to the entire public, only if they took a step to provide or form a special relationship with particular individuals, then you'd have a private duty. And that was called the public-private duty distinction, which apparently is recognized in U.S. v. Page, has not been the law in Arizona for 30 years, State versus Ryan. It just doesn't apply in our state.
Because of the Supreme Court remand, we were supposed to look what the liability of an individual would be in Arizona.
That's right.
And apparently this, I'm going to read this again. I'm quickly referring to my notes, but here he seems to look at the organization Kirk and Varlin being part of the organization of government and whether the government would be liable. And are you saying that's where he misstates on Page?
Well, the public-private duty distinction comes out of government liability. But my point is, whether you're a public inspector, whether you're an insurance company inspector, whether you're as a work comp, any of those people who provide a safety inspection does so on behalf of the class of people who are protected by that safety inspection under the restatement and under Arizona law. And the case that Judge Burry relies on finds an exception to that rule because of what used to be a government immunity exception, U.S. v. Page. And so if the court wants to actually then get to, okay, well, say Judge Burry's wrong on that, what do we say? Is there any evidence of reliance? Well, and there's lots of evidence. First, I have affidavits from the people involved that they relied on MSHA. Secondly, I have the testimony, this also came out new in the discovery, of the MSHA inspector, Mr. Varlin, that said, yes, it's entirely reasonable that these people rely on us and anticipate that we will fix the safety problems, or we will cause to be fixed the safety problems that we find in this mine. Then I have the notice of termination, termination, where Varlin is terminated by Jake D. Herrera. He writes a letter saying, you as the mine inspector are relied on for the safety of all of the miners in those mines you inspect. And then when Varlin appeals that to a guy named Irwin Hooker, who is an actual district manager. D. Herrera was an acting district manager. There is another letter, and all of these are in the ER, saying you are relied on. So everybody who has actually testified in this case or provided documentary evidence says these guys rely on the mine inspectors. And so there's a triable issue of fact under 324A, unless you run into the public-private distinction, which isn't Arizona law. And again, under 324A, it relies, on the reporter notes, State v. Clymer, on a mine inspection case. So you don't need to worry about that.
So your short answer here, or what I understand you saying, is we reverse because he improperly granted summary judgment, number one. I don't know about the motion to dismiss, but the grant summary judgment sounds like we have disputed issue facts. Got to go back.
That's right. But on the motion to dismiss, we have disputed issues of fact, too, and the summary judgment standard should have applied.
Same thing, that the courts have simply adopted the motion to dismiss terminology but recognize in our case law that those are really factual questions that have to be evaluated as if there were a motion.
That's correct, and that case law is cited in our briefs. And the only other thing, as I say, if you actually look at the record, you might decide that reasonable people couldn't differ and rule in our favor, because I'm pretty darn sure when you fire the inspector, you demote the other guy, and the president tells them to write you a letter saying how sorry they are that these guys violated policy, maybe reasonable people couldn't come to the opposite conclusion. Thank you.
Okay, we'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Starring Donnelly from the United States. The district court here correctly concluded that the challenged actions fell squarely within the discretionary function exception. I think the most important case for us, and I think this case is virtually indistinguishable from the Supreme Court's case in Varig Airlines, in which the court said, where an agency determines the extent to which it will supervise the safety procedures of private individuals, it is exercising discretionary regulatory authority of the most basic kind. And that's, of course, exactly what MSHA is doing here. It is determining the extent to which it will supervise the safety procedures. Moreover, the court went on to say,
we have a body of evidence here that, looking backwards, granted it's after the fact, and everybody's trying to make nice to the victims and cover their backside and say it wasn't my fault, but you have a pretty substantial body of evidence that suggests that these guys did what they weren't supposed to do, and the agency wasn't trying to say it could pick and choose what kind of inspection it would do at a time like that.
I actually don't think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that the MSHA policies all along have been very clear that the mine inspectors, Varland here, and the supervisors, Kirk, have ample discretion in how to deal with. There are two separate sort of things that they're challenging. One is Kirk's decision not to order an immediate investigation. I should point out that their challenge to Kirk's action is really about the timing of the inspection, because Kirk, of the September 1999 investigation, of course, happened before the January 2000 accident.
Well,
and so it's really about the immediacy of it.
Well, do we run into, let's get right down to it, do we run into a disputed issue of fact on the facts that were ultimately determined with the first factual determinations and the subsequent discovery that there's a disputed issue of fact of what was told by Kirk to Garland, or Varland?
Kirk to Varland? Well, it's undisputed that Kirk told Varland about the complaints and asked him to look into them in his next investigation. That's at.
And the tapes, the taped-off areas?
The taped-off areas it's not clear whether he told him about that, but that's not relevant. Again, what's important
is that's the one that fell in.
There's no requirement for Varland to have gone into taped-off areas because.
Well, explain that to me.
Well. Look, taped off areas are taped off oftentimes. In fact, and the MSHA regulations require this if they're unsafe. And Varland, you know, had discretion as to whether to go into barricaded areas or not. When this case went back on remand, there was ample discovery about this. There was Robert Friend, the MSHA Deputy Assistant Secretary, testified that inspectors generally do not go out into barricaded areas because of safety concerns.
Now, let's stop there just a second. Number one, am I understanding correctly that the law requires the mine to be fully inspected four times a year?
It says in its entirety, but it does not. What it does not say is in its entirety, including areas that have not been used. In this case, this particular stope 215 North, hadn't been used in 2 years before the accident.
An obligation to find out whether the taped off areas have been used, which they were.
This is not, that's not the relevant question is whether Varland had discretion when he was when he was on his mine inspection, and there's no question that he had discretion, notwithstanding the order, any orders.
There is a question because number one, he was told to do it, and two, inspecting the entire mine doesn't leave any discretion, does it?
It absolutely leaves discretion. What we have to look for mandatory directives is a specific mandatory directive.
Is there anything that says you don't have to inspect the taped-off areas?
Absolutely. The MSHA has had consistent interpretations of the entire mine when the Act says you have to inspect the entire mine. They say what that means is you focus on the areas that are actually being used. These mines are enormous operations.
Yeah, but
there are parts that haven't been used.
Focus on what's being used.
That's correct. Here, this
means that if it's been taped off, it isn't being used.
Well, the thing is, a mine inspector has to have discretion as to determine whether a particular area is mined off. They, of course, have discretion to go into areas that have been barricaded, but they have to have discretion to decide whether they're going to go into that area that's been barricaded off or not, because based on what they see on the ground. And if they have that discretion, the Supreme Court in Galbraith has made it clear that it must be presumed that if there is discretion, that the agent's acts are grounded in policy when exercising that discretion. That's core discretionary function.
Where did the accident take place? Was it an area that was taped off at the time of the inspection?
At the time of the inspection, it hadn't been used in 2 years. That's at excerpts of record tab 10, page 40. It's the report of MSHA that discusses, and their second amended complaint discusses this as well, that this particular area hadn't been used in 2 years. And so it's undisputed that this area hadn't been taped off as Varland was walking up, that this area hadn't been used in 2 years, and 2 weeks before the accident in question, ASARCO opened up this area again. This is still 215 North, opened up this area again to allow the miners to go back in. And so, you know, there's no dispute here that
wait a minute. 2 weeks before what?
2 weeks before the accident took place in January of 2000, this particular area where the accident took place opened up again. And so at the time of the inspection of September 1999, for nearly 2 years, this particular area hadn't been used. And there can't be. It's simply illogical to have a requirement that areas that haven't been used in years and sometimes, you know, in 10 years or decades, these are enormous operations again, that those every inch of even unused areas have to be investigated. That's simply illogical.
Just a second. We're making this argument for the last some minutes. To what issue does this argument pertain to? Does it pertain to the motion to dismiss, or does it pertain to summary judgment? And what precise issue does it pertain to? Does it have anything to do with the jurisdiction?
Well, it pertains to the discretionary function question, whether Varland acted with whether Varland was acting in a discretionary manner when he
and
was investigating the mine.
Assume that your argument is adhered to. I'm just saying for point of argument, and we find that that was discretion. Then what's the next analysis?
If there was discretion, then the question is whether it was the kind of discretion that was grounded in policy considerations. That's the second prong of Galbraith, and I'm happy to talk about that. I think, you know, and again, as Galbraith noted, that it's presumed that when an agent is acting with discretion, that it's exercising the policy. And the policy of the statute, of course.
Let's assume that he was exercising the policy. Now what?
Well, then there's no jurisdiction. Then
because an exception to the waiver of sovereign immunity.
Exactly correct, Your Honor.
Didn't we decide that the other way in the first case?
That's correct, Your Honor, but that opinion was vacated by the Supreme Court, and they haven't really grappled with the fact that the Supreme Court's cases are clear that when a court of appeals...
Doesn't that run us into the law of the case problem?
No, because once a case has been vacated, then it has no precedential effect anymore. And, of course, in any event, on remand...
You've seen citations that cite a case and then say vacated or reversed on other grounds.
It's
not unusual to see such citations.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but it's not law of the case. In that case, it may be persuasive authority, and this Court certainly can look at that.
Well,
I would point out in the earlier case, this issue of what the Court really went on was the meaning of in its entirety in the Mine Act.
This is important because it's important to me to figure out the structure, how to decide your case. If in fact, the Supreme Court, which it did, took our case on cert, it only took the tort issue.
That's correct.
Okay. So it didn't rule on the if you will, the jurisdictional issue or the waiver of sovereign immunity, right?
We didn't seek cert on that question. That's correct.
They vacated our opinion. The opinion's gone.
Yes.
And has no presidential value.
Exactly.
There's another doctrine of law of the case that has value to us.
Law of the case only applies to opinions that have not been vacated. They only apply to...
What's your authority for that?
Well, we cite several cases in our brief that talk about a case... Law of the case only really applies if the prior panel decision has precedential effect. Once a case is vacated, it evaporates.
You're ignoring what Judge Clifton talked about. There are issues in cases that have been reversed by prior decisions or by the Supreme Court or subsequent decisions. But the law, there may be law of the case buried in there, and you're saying if it's vacant, it's all gone.
There's no law of the case once.
And we can once, and therefore.
I would encourage you to look at that to the extent that you find it persuasive. But it's not binding on this panel.
We're here. So if it's not law of the case, then our remand to the district court allow the district court to explore every issue in the case.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This court's remand order didn't limit the district court's opinion. Of course, this is a jurisdictional issue, so that can be raised.
Remand was fairly specific on investigating the tort issue. It didn't say anything about jurisdiction.
It was silent about it, but of course, if this court's when this court remands and it's silent, we have a discussion in a footnote in our brief that it didn't. I think the case is. I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's in a footnote in our brief where we discuss this very issue.
For the footnote, what is the point of it?
Well, the point is that as long as you have remanded and you were silent about whether the court could reconsider the discretionary function question, the court was free to consider that issue.
Okay, so the next step is when it went back, we said they could take discovery, should take discovery. So the discovery did it produce some new facts?
Well, there were additional declarations from various MSHA officials, including Robert Friend, who discusses this whole the consistent interpretation of MSHA that in its entirety does not mean including areas that have been barricaded off. That generally they don't inspect those areas, and that again goes back to the question of whether Varland, when he went to the mine, had discretion to go into or not go into barricaded areas.
Well, okay, let's slow down right there. Counsel for the appellant says there's disputed issues of fact mixed into what we're talking about here. You say there was no abuse of discretion, or they had discretion to do this, so you would trump that, wouldn't you?
That's correct, Your Honor.
If you lose your trump, then we're back to disputed issues of fact.
If you were to find that Varland had no discretion, that mine inspectors are required to go into areas of the mine that have been closed for years and perhaps decades.
I'm not trying to degrade that argument. I'm just saying if that argument isn't there.
If there's no discretion in general, if there's no discretion, if you fail the prong one of the Berkovitz test, then you can go to the second question. You can go to the state law issue.
Counsel has raised some pretty interesting questions about the fact of disputed issues of fact for that determination
on the state law issue, the Good Samaritan case. I think there are again.
Before we get to the state law, I wanted to direct your attention to quote the concluding paragraph of the Supreme Court opinion, in which it says, parties disagree about precisely which Arizona tort law doctrine applies here. We remand the case so that the lower courts can decide this matter in the first instance. The judgment of the Ninth Circuit is vacated, and the case is remanded for proceedings consistent with that opinion. Doesn't that mean that, in effect, it's being remanded to undertake that specific thing that they just discussed? That is, whether the tort law in Arizona is affected, not into the discretionary function.
In a word, no, Your Honor. I mean, the discretionary function exception is a jurisdictional issue. It's a jurisdictional question. And, of course, even if we had not raised it before, we could vacate.
And we remand the case so that the lower courts can distinguish this matter in the first instance, and that is about the Arizona tort law. That's all they're remanding for.
Of course, they were dealing with the limited issue of whether you have to look for a private person analog or you could rely on the liability of a public entity. That didn't address the jurisdictional issue. The jurisdictional issue is a threshold question that this court under Steel Co. must reach before it gets to the underlying state tort law issue. And so I would say that If we were not to have raised it at all and this it came back down and we were to have raised a jurisdictional issue in the first instance, this court would be obligated under Steel Co. to consider that issue. We've been raising the discretionary function question all along. We didn't seek cert on it, but we raised it again in the trial court, and the court was obligated to take a look at it.
It comes very close to what Judge Clifton said, where the Supreme Court will vacate for the purpose of discussing a particular issue.
This was not a limited remand. They vacated the Ninth Circuit's decision. If they had left the Ninth Circuit's decision in place and only vacated part of it, they could have, I mean, I don't know what they could have done. They vacated the entire decision, however, and that leaves open.
Could they really have done anything else? Only one question was in front of them, and all they really care about is the bottom line. Well, you can't have judgment in favor of the United States after what they said here, or rather, judgment in favor of plaintiff after what they said here.
Right.
So it's hard to take the Supreme Court's decision as saying much of anything with regard to
the. I think in the end that's the right answer, that the Supreme Court didn't really consider this, wasn't really thinking about this particular issue, and it's open to this court. Again, because the Ninth Circuit's earlier panel decision was this court's earlier panel decision was vacated, to reconsider the issue anew. And I think, given especially the additional development on remand, particularly the friend deposition, the friend declaration, Varlin's declaration that he told, Kirk's declaration that he told Varlin to look into these issues, I think that makes, there may be disputed issues of fact, but they're not material to the discretionary function question. Again, this case is really indistinguishable from this court's decision in Cunningham, which involved OSHA inspections, and the Supreme Court's decision in Varig Airlines. My time's up. I don't know if you want me to continue on to particular issues. I can discuss the state law issue, Your Honor.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'd like to know your answer to counsel's comment on the district court's decision relative to the tort issue, where he recited that Tenth Circuit case and the federal law, rather than the Arizona 324 issue.
Well, I think the district court was applying 324. There's sort of several elements of 324. There's the preamble to 324, which discusses whether one undertakes to provide a service to a particular person, and the court said, "No, this is not an undertaking of to provide a service." I think the district court was really following this court's decisions in Roberson and Jeffries, which involved where this court came out exactly the same way. In fact, I think Roberson involved Arizona law, and those were cases involving they were discussing the Good Samaritan doctrine. Those were cases involving contracts to do certain services where the private individual had primary responsibility for safety, and the government retained a right for inspection. And there were suits for negligent inspection, just as this one, and this court said in both Roberson and Jeffries that that is not undertaking to provide a service. But even putting that aside, there of course they have to meet the other. Even if the district court erred in that respect, they have to meet the other requirements. One of the other requirements of 324A, which are whether it increased the risk of damages. I don't think they're really seriously contending that we.
The district court has an extensive discussion of 324 in here, and including the Arizona case of, I can't pronounce it, Papathasis.
Papathasis, yeah.
Papathasis. So it did discuss those. So
yes.
So tell me what your analysis is of how the district court used the remand was specifically to find out what the Arizona law. The Supreme Court said, "Gee, we don't know really what there's a dispute amongst the parties what the controlling Arizona law is. So you're saying that that this analysis is the correct Arizona law in spite of what counsel...
No, it's absolutely the correct. I mean, he's applying the language of the restatement, and in particular, he's focusing on the preamble of that part, which talks about undertaking to provide services to another. And he says, well, this is not an undertaking to provide a service to another. He instead said, and that's what this court's reasoning.
Why isn't this an undertaking to provide services to the minor?
Well, what this court said in Roberson and in Jeffries was in this case, in Roberson again was was a case involving Arizona law. It said this is an undertaking to provide a service to a SARCO because what all the inspector is doing is ensuring compliance with the regulations. That's not a service to a SARCO.
A whole lot of evidence that the miners were certainly relying on.
The question on reliance isn't simply just general reliance. It's specifically legal reliance. It has to be justifiable. I would point this court to the Sixth Circuit case.
Why would that be justifiable? You've got mine inspectors coming in. Certainly, they're not coming in for the benefit, really, of the employer. They're coming in to make sure that the miners are protected, are they not?
They're coming in for the benefit of the public to ensure the operation, the continued operation of the mining industry. There's an incidental benefit.
Stop there. I mean, do you think the legislation was passed to make sure, what was coming out of this mine anyway? Was it coal? Coal?
I don't think it was coal.
Copper? Do you think the act was passed to make sure we had a steady supply of copper? I think
there were several purposes.
The alternative. I would agree with you if the mining company came in and said, hey, we've lost our mine, and if you'd inspected it better, we wouldn't have had this problem, so you, government, owe us. No, the statute wasn't set up to protect the mining company. But I don't think it was set up to protect the steady flow of copper either. It was the miners that caused this. And although I see the statute puts the primary responsibility on the mine operators, as it should, it's just very difficult to escape the possibility, at least, and this is where we get to the question whether there's a disputed issue of fact, that the miners themselves were looking to the government because they knew they couldn't trust their employer.
Well, it wouldn't be very justifiable. I would point out that the Mine Act puts primary responsibility not just on the mine operator, but the mine operator in cooperation with the miners. The government is there. They do four spot checks.
Mining deaths in the 1920s than there are in the 2000-aughts. And what's the real difference? We started having mine inspections. The government played a role.
I would again just point this court to the Sixth Circuit's reasoning in Myers, which talks about whether reliance is justifiable in light of the way that this entire scheme is set up. The scheme isn't set up that there is a federal mine inspector there all the time looking at day-to-day operations. These mines are complicated things. They change every day. And all the government does is they come in four times a year. It's a spot check, essentially, similar to Varig.
They're to examine the whole mine.
The entire mine, yes, but it's only four times a year. That's what the statute requires. That's what they do. Of course, in between those quarterly results, there may be different things going on. Sorry, I apologize.
It would make you feel better if you are a miner to know that four times a year someone is coming in to look at it from the standpoint of safety for them, as opposed to the employer who has certainly some concern for the miners, but also there's a profit problem.
Well, and for Arizona law, what reliance requires is the miners to have foregone some other remedy, that there has to be some evidence. That's what the case law says in Arizona, that they have to have forewent some other course of action, and there's no evidence here that they did they would have done something differently if they couldn't rely on the federal mine inspections. And so, I mean, I think that reliance and the Sixth Circuit case is quite clear about this, that any reliance would be not justifiable.
The Sixth Circuit.
Yes, it's Myers versus United States.
Yeah, we're talking about Ninth Circuit.
Of course. But, you know, I think the reasoning is quite persuasive in that case. I'm trying to see anything else. I think that's all I have. If there are no further questions.
No, we've given you a sufficient workout, I guess.
Yeah.
And we appreciate the guidance you've given us. We'll have a brief rebuttal.
All right. 2 minutes, if I might. Okay, just very briefly. On the remand issue, I think the court has correctly suggested today, it's the intent of the court that issues the remand. And this court is in as good a position or better than either the United States or myself to determine what did the Supreme Court mean when it remanded the case and what did this court mean when it remanded it to the district court. I would suggest there's no real evidence that this court intended to disturb its earlier decision that discretionary function didn't apply in this case. If the court feels otherwise, I would think all the evidence just further bolsters that decision. The second point, the counsel makes a lot of point about this stope being closed for 2 years, and I'm sure he wasn't involved in discovery. This is a mine that actually, it looks like a clover, and there's hundreds of stopes as you go. They go through stopes every few weeks. They exhaust the ore, move the next one, exhaust the ore, move the next one. Our allegations in this case is that for a long time, for at least all of the time that complaints were being made, ASARCO was doing this dangerous fanback stoping and then taping off the stopes under work at the time of the inspections, and that's specifically what the complaint was, and that's specifically what the evidence in the discovery came out was. Varlin said he didn't remember Kirk telling him about that, and Ratliff said Ratliff was the investigator hired by MSHA, the MSHA district manager himself, who said there's absolutely no evidence that they investigated this, although they should have. So I don't know what discretion, you know, what discretionary choice is being protected here, because Kirk thought, at least Kirk's testimony thought, well, he was saying, you know, look at all of these things. But there's no evidence they looked at that by MSHA's own investigation. And the last thing.
Can I stop you right there?
Yeah.
Am I misreading the record or remembering the record that Varlin, at one inspection, did look behind some tapes, but not in the one in September?
I think that there is a suggestion, and frankly, this point is cloudy in my mind. I think there was some suggestion in the post-investigation that there was some evidence that that was true, but it's disputed.
Okay.
The last point I wanted to make, Your Honor, is I think the court is misreading Judge Burry's order. When you say Judge Burry talked extensively about 323, if you look at the court's order, he goes through for about 15 pages talking about what does the defendant say and what does the plaintiff say, and talks about 323 based on the party's contentions. When he then gets to hit the court's analysis, he makes his decision only on the basis that there were not rendering services. And that's beginning, I believe, at page 33 and then going forward. And so nothing before that is really the court's own analysis. And the basis for Judge Burry's decision, I maintain, is simply not Arizona law, the public-private basis. And reliance, with all due respect to the Sixth Circuit, whether there was reliance is a fact issue. And we have some pretty good facts here. And we should get our trial on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for the argument. The case just argued is submitted. And we move to Citizens for Better Forestry versus the U.S. Department of Agriculture.